Lisa put in a word again myself, working on Patreon Andy's story. She's also here. I would like to take this moment to recognize Joel Isaacs, who is in the room with us today. Joel, if you could make sure to make some respects. And Joel is the tribal liaison for the Department of Education and Early Development, and who is a leading staff of the state board meeting. So thank you, Joel, for coming today. Good to see you. And I'd like for the record to reflect that Matt Brooks has joined us at Adams Flyers. Before we begin, please, a reminder to silence your phones and if online, YouTube microphones, of course, unless you have a speaker. This morning, we will hear more guest speakers discussing culturally relevant education in Alaska. We are privileged to have first speakers with us this morning, Dr. Lincoln Cordae and his Madison Crow. I'm the president of First Alaska Institute. I'm the director of Baxter. Lance Cunier Churchill, associate professor of Alaska Native Languages at UAS, and superintendent Karen Walker of Northwest Arctic Federal School District. I can see superintendent Walker is in line with us now, so I'll be speaking later. And Bruce Chase, for being here with us today. I asked Dr. Madison Cross to tell us this morning on understanding culturally relevant education by sharing her perspectives on how state policy on education has affected Alaskans and children and their families, and also our English as a second language learners. As we need our two important jobs of making state policy, we want to make sure we are learning from our history and the present and creating policies for all of our children to be successful. And before we start, I'd like to remind you that Representative Michael Rogers joined us at 8:07. Dr. Cornet, as we have come, please state your name and any affiliation for the record and begin your presentation. Welcome.
Can you hear me okay? I'm getting a echo on your end.
No, you sound very clear.
Okay, wonderful. My name is Lankanai. This is Madison Crow. I'm president of Thinget. I come from Kiowa, which is where I'm coming to you today from. In the heart of Tsingetani, in the middle of Southeast Alaska. So about 100 miles south of where you're from, I'm a Thinget side, I'm really a tribe, fresh water, Zapia Island. On my Haida side, I am Evo, Teachkit Mae, and we are the Hummingbird people. I also am the president and CEO of First Alaskans Institute, a statewide Alaska Native nonprofit and operating foundation. My mission is progress for the next 10,000 years. I want to thank the co-chairs and the representatives for inviting me to share my perspectives with you this morning. And I know it's 8 a.m., so a nice bright start to a new week, so thank you for the invitation. This morning, as I thought about what I wanted to share with you, I will be very honest. This is a very critical area, and I'm so glad you folks are working to get this information on the record as you deliberate legislation in the House and Senate. And that's important. For me as an Alaska Native woman, my educational experience in Alaska's public schools was a very painful experience. And that's the cover of the story. Our goal, my goal, ultimate goal is to make it so that our children thrive in their educational experiences in this state. And they don't have the kinds of experiences that I and too many others have had. So I have to say that right up front. Because I'm coming into this presentation, or really conversation, carrying a lot of emotion and stuffed up emotions of frustration, of hurt, of anger. Last week, our organization held a statewide tribunal on local schools. I heard from a number of our Alaska Native people, from young people to elders, sharing about the impacts that Alaska's education policy has had on us. And so as I speak to you, my heart is in my throat, because this just was at the end of the week. And I can't disassociate those stories from what you've asked me to speak about here this morning. Nor can I. Alaska education policy on territorial days through today remain the same. And that policy has been to assimilate Native people. And we're suffering with those consequences every day in our families and our communities. And so as I try to put my heart and mind together so that I could respond to Representative Story's request, the only way that I knew I could do this is to just be very honest with you about where I am right now and where too far many of our people are and why this is such an incredibly important conversation and learning that your committee is on. When I think about the context of what Alaska Native education is, I don't start at colonization. Because it existed here since the beginning of time. But it stopped being utilized in the territorial base of Alaska. It has not been included in our school system since, without a fight, without a struggle, without litigation. This is the education policy in Alaska. I was listening to a story this morning to try to get myself centered. And it was a story that I was told by my mommy, my grandmother, about our people's preparations for a journey. And she told me this story at different points in my life. And each time she told the story, I learned something else from it. As a child, sometimes we get frustrated because, especially these days, we hear something more than once. We're like, oh, I know already. I heard that already. You told me that already. And if anybody has children or teenagers in their house, you're probably used to that refrain. But it is the way that knowledge was transmitted. And as a child, I heard the story, and I connected to it in one way. As an older child, I heard the story and I connected to it in another way. As a young teen, communicated and discerned and connected to it in another way. The older team and heard the story and connected to it in another way. And as an adult, hearing it each time now, we hear something different. The story is teaching me. At every point along my life journey, I'm gaining knowledge from my ancestors in a way that when I heard it when I was younger, I couldn't understand or hear because I didn't have the context of life to give it to me. This is a lasting of education. We come to the knowledge that is there for us to learn. Our people around us in our community steward our connection to that knowledge. Through the way that we go out to hunt and fish and gather and harvest and share and have ceremony. Through the way that we are related, understanding our kinship systems. Through our clan systems, how they're related, what they do for each other, the balance that they create. We refer to it as, you know, our clan is opposite from us, like opposites. When a Western complex, opposition sounds like adversarialism. But in our cultural context, it means balance and it means love. It means how you take care of the people in your community. Education was not separate from my life. Everything that we did was integrated into the way that we were learning. And everybody had a really important role. Even the little ones, as soon as they start to learn how to engage and be around people, they have a role. They start walking, being around. They can start bringing water to people as they walk. Everyone is learning together, being together, working together. This is how we survived here in Alaska for thousands of years. It's one of the most beautiful things about Alaska, that our Alaskan Native cultures are so diverse from one another, so geographically distinct and culturally diverse from one another, that I, as a Tlingit woman, am as different to a Yupik woman as I am to a Cherokee woman in Oklahoma. That's how different we are here. Alaska is built on diversity. And that diversity is a strength. But we have not packed it in the education of our children. In fact, we have left these very distinct cultural understandings, knowledges, ways of being, outside on purpose. So when we think about what culturally relevant education means in Alaska, we have to go beyond the linear time frame of colonization in Alaska, because that doesn't tell us what Alaska Native education is. It tells us what it isn't. And I want to be sure to tell all of you that there are incredible Alaska Native people who are here who can share with you the context of what that means, and it flows in every single region and every single village in this state. It is still here. That knowledge is here. We just have not tapped it. We hosted a series of coffee times, what we call coffee times at Personal Excellence Institute, where we invite guests to talk about topics that are meaningful and relevant to our community. And this February, we held 3 Zooms, and I'll provide the links in an email for the record following this. We held 3 coffee times with Professor Graham, Abraham Smith from Otago, who's Dylan Kismali. He's an internationally distinguished scholar, academician. His wife, Linda Tumahi Smith, also a professor who is internationally distinguished. Brenda Bouvier was the former past president of Tamil.org, who is and was the leader of the national tertiary education system, upward of 33,000 students enrolled in those schools. And then we have the honor of hosting our own people. Julie Kipta, the president of Alaska Federation of Natives, who was a partner with us in these graphic series. Lisa Wayne, who is the executive director of the Chickling Traditional Council, and served before that as the education and health director for the tribe, running the Yanibaba Tribal School. Also, Dana Hortarek, who was the leader in the National School District for the Inuvik Learning Framework up until her retirement. And your next person who will be providing testimony, Hane Lance Twitchell. And I'm saying that because what we have happening in Alaska is not unique to us in terms of how we value our local knowledge holders. It's something that, you know, the world struggles with. But there's that saying, you know, you can't be a prophet to your own people. And one of the things that we heard from our Maori relatives is that they actually credit Alaska Native educators for helping them create a an Indigenous learning framework for their Maori students in New Zealand back in the 80s. Their Kaupapa Maori system that they created, they utilized Alaska Native educators' innovation and excellence. And the first time I traveled down there, they credited people like Pastor Kawaii for helping them completely revamp their educational system to create a pathway that allowed their Maori students to actually start achieving and thriving within their educational system in Aotearoa. And they used their cultural education standards and the cultural relevant education frameworks and philosophies that were developed during Alaska for them to do this work in New Zealand in the 1980s and the 1990s. It's time for Alaska to do the same. And we have these incredible educators here who have gone through the Western schooling system, have received their PhDs, and who have the ability to sit down and talk to you about how to establish schools that work. But they're not being listened to. And I am so excited about these hearings because I understand that that's your intent, is to get their excellent knowledge and expertise on the record to help you as legislators make informed decisions that support thriving schools for Native students in Alaska. And there are many things that have already been done over the past few decades. So again, I'll bring a citation list and email it for the record. But there's been a number of different studies done that talk about the history of how education has happened here in Alaska, that outline all of the different shifts in federal policy that bring us to today. And there are some educational programs that actually kind of outline date by date when some of these significant things happened. And as I was going through the list myself, start refreshing myself on some of these things. I was hearing this morning, a couple things really stood out to me. Our book changes and shifts. There were changes and shifts to a system led by and owned by Native people. It was always a shift to actually push us further away from who we are. The terminology may have changed, but the actual operations, curriculum, and achievement, ability, and capacity of our children has not. During the last governor's administration, Commissioner Michael Johnson held the Alaska Education Outreach Challenge and convened Alaskans from across the state in multiple different sectors and essentially said, we know that we are failing our students. We need innovative ideas on how we can change this. And there was a committee from tribal and community leadership. I served on that committee along with many others. We were charged with providing three innovative ideas for how we could revamp, retool, rebirth Alaska's education system to achieve better results for our students, our families, and our communities. And in our committee, the conversations that we had resulted in us coming forward with only one innovation, and that was compacting with tribes. That would be a historic moment because it would actually, for the first time since colonization, create a policy that would allow for that tribal knowledge, that native knowledge, that native identity to be centered in education and to be utilized as a medium of instruction and not just a subject matter for one-on-one classes, but create the educational philosophy and framework. This is how we will see major shifts and the outcomes of our students. Right now, when we think about Alaska Native education achievements, too often we are faced with the fact that there is still segregation happening in our schools. Whether intended or not, when we look at those outcomes, we see a vast and stark difference. And we have education experts in Alaska who can help us shape a completely different outcome for our students. And other tribal partners, tribal governments who could be right there alongside the state, serving these state citizens, these tribal citizens in a unique government-to-government relationship. That has so much promise for where we could go with this. But I cannot break myself away from what I heard last week and what I've been hearing my whole life growing up around the fact that too often we have been in a situation where who we are has been weaponized against us within the education system in Alaska. When I was in high school in Juneau, I don't know how I made it through, honestly. I had a teacher, her name was Karen Price, and I was in the AP classes. And I don't usually be able to just put forward enough effort to get by. in and I went to talk to her about it. And she told me, and this is the first time I heard this, but I think I was a junior in high school at the time. You can do so much better than this. You're capable of so much more. I have the highest expectations of you. And she looked at me like she actually cared about me. When I was in college, I ran into her at the restaurant, which used to be the prospector. And I went up to her and I thanked her. I thanked her for seeing me and for letting me know that I was capable of more. There's a saying, the third bigotry of my expectations. Have you read it? It's not just the upfront, in your face, racism. It's the smaller things that are built into the system that end up really impacting the outcome of any student's ability to thrive in school. You know where I was in the AP classes when I was in high school in Juneau? Because my mother, when we moved to Juneau, because we had to move to Juneau when I was in the fourth grade, because my sister was in the math genius. And had gone through, she's 2 years older than me, she had gone through the entire school curriculum for math and kink. She was in sixth grade. And my parents made the decision, along with my grandparents and our family, that we needed to move to Juneau so that she could have better access. So we had to move to get better education. And that was a massive sacrifice for my family. And it was a really painful, horrible experience for me. And my sister ended up being amazing in math and science. And ended up being the first Quintet woman to graduate from MIT. But how did that happen? It happened because when we moved to Juneau, we had to test for whether we could go into the gifted and talented program. And then we both passed. The school principal called my mother and told her, well, since you guys just moved from the village, your girls are socially ready to go into the regular classes here for the different talent program. So we're going to put them in the lower level classes. And Juneau at the time was a tracking system. Once you're in that level, that's how you stay. Did we know that? No. But what my mother told that principal still means so much to this day. And she told that principal, my girls are in the gifted and talented program tomorrow, or I'll come back here with my attorney. And then she showed up to everything. She showed up to every assembly, every concert. She wasn't in the PTA. She wasn't a big speaker or trying to run for positions or anything like that, but she was there. As a child growing up, of course, I was like, nobody else is going to hear for everything, you know? I'm sure if you have children, you've heard that from your children as well. was in college when my mom actually told me what happened. I had no idea that she had to do that for us. And it made total sense that that's why she was there so much. Because she had to make sure, keep her eyes on people and let them see her keeping her eyes on them to make sure that we were treated okay. She didn't tell me any of that until I did my trials. We shouldn't have to require our native children to leave their homes to get a fair education anymore. It's already been litigated, but yet somehow we continue to not have the same offerings, the same support, the same belief in those schools. And that is something that needs to change. When I think about where we have been with the boarding schools and its impact on our people, this is not devoid of Alaskans. This is Alaska's history. And every time the state gets in a financial pinch, what is one of the first solutions people put forward? Well, we should start talking about going back to boarding schools, regional boarding schools. And they're back to who? We still haven't recovered from what has been done to us. This is an intergenerational issue. When our cultures, our languages are not even allowed to be considered as regular course content and curriculum, our values are operationalized within school systems, it just compounds what was already done. It makes it worse. The only way that I made it through the public education system in Alaska is because when I started at home in my village. I was a Head Start kid. We were the first group of kids who were able to sing and dance in our language since the U.S. had outlawed our religion, as they called it then, and had left the American, and had created the American Indian Religious Freedom Act in the 70s. So my group was born December 25th, 1971. So my group of Head Start kids were the first ones that got to actually start learning our language and our dances. And growing up in my village with my family on the land, on the waters, working together, learning how to care for our communities, learning who I was, my identity. That allowed me to survive the public school system once we moved from our village to Juneau. That's what allowed me to survive. The Senate Committee on Indian Affairs just held a field hearing in Anchorage last week on the 24th. It's available online as well. I'll send a link to it for the record as well. One of the persons who provided testimony was William Manning from Hooper Bay. And he was asked, hold on, I'm so sorry. Making some coffee here at the house, I guess. So William Manning said something that I thought was really beautiful as a way to settle my comments here. explain something on the test. You asked him, you know, what it was that he wished for. I think what happened was contacting over schools and a lot of stuff. And he said that our tribes know that what's before them is theirs. And that our children learn how to be stewards of their communities again. And that's something that I think is a vision we can get behind. Because it's something that we've heard over and over and over again. When the schools are biased and porous, when the people who are in those schools who construct, administer, and operate those schools look at us with love, that's when we're going to thrive. Peyton Polly Schaefer, in front of you, who were instrumental in the forming of the Kitchwit, which is the traveling man in that language immersion school, in front of you. He sent me an email. Pete sent me an email a while back, and he said, when we were talking about, because we were in this conversation about Native education. And he said, the first and foremost subject is respect. Our worldview, respect is lacking all the way around, especially in areas like politics, religion, and society in general, especially our youth. Some of our students who show us that the kids at the start of the school year in the fall demonstrate a lack of comprehension as to what respect is, and they are taught in a new context as to what respect is, and really show improvement in their social interactions once they understand what respect is. The other thing is that learning the comprehension of respect in a loving setting is much more meaningful to the child as compared to the other classrooms where respect is not a priority in the learning process. The outcome is remarkably different in how the students behave socially as well as academically when they leave the teacher. Agnet and I discussed our experience in both schools and came up with the idea that perhaps respect in itself should be a part of the educational process and that it should be a required course in all of the educational delivery systems. What that might look like should be inclusive of traditional teaching of respect, which would add some sense of not only community ownership, but to make the knowledge of our elders valuable and useful. It would be a great subject to discuss as in and of itself, and the value would be in instilling respect of self to our traditional culture, and especially to our elders, as a reciprocal value that would add to the second subject, which is identity. Sandy Kowalski, who also testified to the Senate Committee on Indian Affairs field hearing on the 24th, also worked with the Kitchwit. And she served in the Northwest Arctic School District as a teacher and an administrator, and most recently an assistant superintendent. She also serves on the State Board of Education. And her testimony to the field hearing was also really critical. And she spoke about the difference in outcomes that she saw as an educator. That the children who came through the Kitchwit not only learned, you know, in an immersion environment, in a profession, or had no problem learning English, and after first coming to school and going through some settling, not only did better academically in their subjects, but they also were high performers in terms of school involvement. They showed up understanding what respect meant. They showed up already really conscious and aware of their role in their community. And their achievements and their outcomes were a reflection of that. We have this knowledge and this expertise in the state already. And we have some incredible educators out there who I hope that you have lined up to testify, but I will also continue to provide names to representative story of FMA potential. Testify before this body. My mother said something to me last night as we were talking about this, I'll share it here. She said, after colonization happened here, higher education, taking 5 and 6 year olds away from their families, never to return. Never to return the same, sometimes never to return at all. Our education meant not letting people know who they were, no culture, no language, no value to who their whole personhood was, their humanity. Our education meant succeeding in spite of the fact that you're Native, not because you are Native. And today we need higher education to mean culturally centered language learning, rooted in community, expansive worldview. That is where we need our education to go. In order to go forward, we have to go back to what is meaningful to our people and create a system that reflects it. Thank you, Shiloh, for letting me share my perspectives with you this morning. And I'll be happy to answer any questions. Again, thank you.
Who's been doing education research in Alaska for a number of decades, Dr. Kasifuana Amrak from the Oklahoma area, who has also been an educator, as well as Melanie Winky, who was a healthcare program and education programs up in the Oklahoma area. Interestingly, one of the takeaways from Ms. Winky felt very similar to something that you just said. She went on to get her college degree and master's degree in spite of her experience in the education system. Much of her testimony, they spoke about the systemic challenges that Alaska Native and bilingual children face in our school systems, and in particular, how standardized assessments put significant pressure on high-stakes decisions for students in a system that has not been designed with their unique needs or cultural heritages in mind. It's interesting your perspective about the quote that there's often a tree of low expectations. As we consider statewide policies to address achievement gaps, particularly in early education as well as K-12, I'm looking to better understand how we build policies that address needing to, the desire to achieve high standards and benchmarks in a way that do not reflect the difficult past of the civilization and colonization that you spoke about, which is rooted a bit in Western educators of feminism. We can't separate the two. The history of it as well as the design of it. And so I'm curious to hear a little bit more from you on as we consider those statewide policies to address the achievement gaps again, where are the systems that we put in place to challenge our students to see them excel, but in a way that does not disenfranchise them from a system that is created largely in a past of assimilation and colonization.
Through the chair, Representative Zelkowski, I want to share a couple quotes that I always think about in relationship to many issues, but specifically, these ones are around education. These quotes are really centered on it. The first one is from when he used to be a representative, and maybe he's a senator now in New Mexico, Benny Shando, who's Pueblo. He said, don't teach me about my culture. Use my culture to teach me. So when you think about those standards that need to be created in order to actually understand what that means and implement it, it's completely different than the ones that are currently in place. Another quote that I think about often is from Tata Mohia, who also heard it from Graham Smith, as I shared with you. They spoke about this as well during our coffee time series. What counts is knowledge. What knowledge counts, and who decides? So when we're thinking about standards, we have to think about, well, whose standards are they? Were they designed for the success of learning instruments? Were they designed using a cultural framework that supports the ability for our Native students to thrive? Or were they designed to continue an assimilationist education philosophy? The current standards that we have today in place are not constructed for Native children to thrive. And in Alaska, we have to do it, not just because it's the right thing to do, but because it's the only way to turn the tide of the Native educational system that's been weaponized against us since colonization began. We can't just not do it. Education is not in a vacuum. So the way that those measures, those standards, and those assessments and evaluations need to be created have to be done in a culturally relevant way connected to culturally relevant school foundations, philosophies, education processes, curriculum, policies. It all has to be tied together. But it's not going to look like what people think it looks like or should look like within a Western education framework. If those were going to work, they would have worked by now. So when I think about the ways that those types of kind of standardized methods should be used, I think about something that was created long ago. And that's the Alaska Native Standards for Culturally Responsive Schools. Those have been around since the 90s. Also not adapted to too many school districts yet. But there has been extensive work done in this area. And when we think about the needs of education, one of the challenges that I've heard that comes up a lot is like, how will we know it's better? How do we know that children will do better when they are loved than when they are not. Only you know that. As a parent, as an auntie, as an uncle, as a grandparent, is it better for your children to be loved or not loved? That's the essential and simple question that's at the heart of this effort. And you know the answer to it. Children cry when they are loved. And an educational system that is wrapping around them and lifting them up is one that they can thrive in. We have not had that in Alaska yet, over the last 200 years. We have before. That's how we know it works.
If we are all Alaskans, should we not stand together to make changes that can create more life? If we are Alaskans together in this great state, can we not do something more than waiting for entire ways of life to be destroyed? Every one of you has exponentially more power than I do, so I'll ask you to make the bold move. I will beg you to do something. For an act like the Alaska Reads Act to include Alaska Native Languages is a great step, but if someone has been attacked and nearly killed, it is not humane to simply let them into a building. You have to help, and you have to change. Education has bloody hands when it comes to Alaska Native Languages. Alaskan teachers wrote books about stuffing chemical silk rags into the mouths of children for speaking their own languages. We have elders who have stood up and are still standing up to share their horrifying stories about the torture they endured at the hands of Alaskan education. I share this with you because I want you to think about something very important. If education was the vehicle used to destroy Alaska Native languages, can we not, as competent and caring human beings, make education into something that we have never seen before in this state? Every Alaskan has a responsibility for what happens with Alaska Native languages. There's no way around it. We have been here, we are here, we will always be here. No one ever had the right to prohibit our languages, but they did. No one ever had the right to abuse a child for being themselves, but they did. What I'm asking for is more than inclusion, more than culturally responsive education. I am talking about shifting education to give us a home on our own ancestral lands. I support the inclusion written in this bill, and I support early literacy and increased support for teachers and students. Even more, I support inclusion at a substantive level. Every student in Alaska should take one semester of Alaska Native language in order to graduate. If that is not the case, then we must be saying that these languages are unimportant. Language teachers and advocates are tired. We're on the verge of failing despite giving it everything we have. Would you not do something if you have the power? We need a pathway for fully licensed and certified teachers of Alaska Native languages. We need a statewide Alaska Native Language Schools Consortium. Last weekend, we lost one of the 11 remaining master-level birth speakers of Alaskan language. The tragedy is, I could not find a way to show her before she left that we were guaranteeing a future for our language. I cannot do that because I feel alone in this world. My words have echoed off the walls of these meeting rooms and chambers, and then have drifted off into space. And not only mine, but so many elders and language learners before me. I can outline a plan. I can collaborate with Hawaiian language leaders, Maori language leaders, Mohawk language leaders, Anishinaabe language leaders, and all the folks I can find who are doing the work. But you all sit in the big chairs. Small steps will not get us out of the situation. But if you can resist the urge to keep things as they are, if you can find the courage to hold our hands until we are safe, then I will belong to you forever. I will forever be grateful that you saw us, heard us, and created the change towards equity that was long overdue. The change for all. Thanks.
I was sitting right close to me, and you have, after this hearing, again, and I see some questions from Dr. Sapolsky. I mean, representative questions, I'm sorry, maybe one or two, regarding Dr. Patel. I had a, you know, after you heard my question that I had from Robin, but I think there will be a similar question to you. This committee is set with a difficult task of considering statewide policies to address achievement gaps in K-12 education.
and early learning is a big focus on early learning and early learning interventions this particular session. And we heard from the Western educators and researchers in the field how state of ed assessments have put significant pressure on high-stakes decisions for students, in particular those students that are part of the system that has not been designed for their unique cultural and language needs. So I'm interested in following up with a challenge that I think when I pose to this committee is moving beyond the self-bigotry of low expectations. What are some recommendations that you might have in terms of how we build policies that are the best use of state resources to make our investments work smarter in a way that is anchored in culturally relevant and culturally based, if you will, education policies? What does that look like from a policy standpoint? It's so much easier to have a macro level discussion about the westernized standards of education and addressing achievement gaps. But when we consider the unique cultural heritages throughout Alaska, not to mention the incredible diversity of the immigrant population in Anchorage, I guess the question that I would pose to you is what are some broad policy considerations that we should take into account to protect the work of the language programs, to protect the work of communities on the ground? What does that look like in our application?
Kashish, through the chair, and how I'm confused to thank Mark and I for all of our testimony this morning. I guess I would have a number of thoughts on this. One is, and I think the standards of education really need to be analyzed in terms of what they do to success rates and who has the opportunities to succeed in education. Historically, that has always been the white population in Alaska. I think education, to be honest, is constructed for them. An example of why that is. If you walk through the halls, maybe that'll be one. Maybe walk through the halls of the building and see if you can find a picture of William Powell in that facility. I hope there's a picture of him somewhere. I bring him up because I was at I was presenting to representatives of student governments across Alaska. So there are about 200 to 300 high-achieving high school students, many of them juniors and seniors, gathered in the town where I was born. So when I started talking to them, I showed them a picture of William Powell, and I said, somebody tell me who this is. And nobody could tell. And I said, well, this individual was the first Alaska Native to become an attorney. This was the first Alaska Native to become a territorial legislator. This was an individual who desegregated Alaska schools, who earned Alaska Natives the right to vote through his work as an attorney, and was one of the founding members of land claim acts in Alaska. And I just wonder, how many students know who he is? So I think we end up with an education system that teaches about Alaska Native peoples as a monolith, as a single entity with no names or faces or histories or specifics. I think a lot of indigenous languages are dying, and people have no obligation through education to learn a single thing. It's an optional program, except for the community of Kona, who I think has implemented a graduation requirement for Alaska Native languages. I think education, in the way it has been constructed, because it was a vehicle of forced assimilation for Alaska Native peoples, my assumption is it's still a vehicle of assimilation unless it's been constructed to absolutely not be so. It takes a real conscious effort to turn that over. And I think standardized testing is something that is an outdated modality of seeing how you're doing in terms of levels of knowledge and students. And my suspicion is a lot of people feel like, well, if there are standards, I guess we'd have chaos and absolute disorder. But I think we could find something better than so you can waste, and then really anchors in the focus on inclusivity, so that students can, they should know about Filipino populations, and especially in our region, a huge impact in terms of historical interactions with indigenous communities, and just what they have done, and the growing populations we have from all over the world. And I think there's a danger in not teaching that, is that all of those people will become nameless, faceless others through the current education system. The schools in Hawaii, Maui in particular, resisted standardized testing to the point where they put potentially the entire state of Hawaii at risk, because the Department of Education said, well, if you don't at least translate these standards and teach to them, we'll withhold all funding from schools in Hawaii. And they stood their ground. And they had similar situations as Los Angeles do in terms of what their graduation rates look like. And we know what they look like. They're horrible. The system fails Los Angeles habitually. And it's okay because we're not fully human beings, and that has a lot of people. Maybe not consciously, people might not consciously say that, but we come from a place that entire systems of laws have been built on the concept. So we'll do it ourselves. What they end up with is a 20-year record of a 100% graduation rate and 80% college placement rate. And those are students that are ready for the modern world. They have high levels of mathematics, science, concepts, technology. They're very successful in what they do. And I think the idea is what we're doing is not working for everybody. So we need to find something that can at least get us closer to the middle.
Some questions, and I do hope that we'll have time for you to talk a little bit about the language test here and some work that these PLL have done. We have a line by Representative Apex.
Thank you, Co-Chair. This is a really interesting discussion we're getting into the agreement. This is a pretty first time that we've heard it, both getting these factors related to the native communities. I'm reminded of the story in the scripture of the Judeo culture, I guess that would be at that point, Old Testament. When Moses was sent to Pharaoh, it wasn't to reform education or to survive. Europe, they were there to escape the centralized system that developed their own cultures in a whole new land. And the original constitution was a decentralized system. And when I first heard the complaints against the Great White Father school system in Lincoln in 1985, and the whole school movement is roughly doing or trying to achieve the same thing, wanting to get people to recognize what was the effect that our children learn and the students around communities. That's what people are trying to do. I've seen a lot of evidence of that in Germany. So this isn't just unique to Alaska natives. It is a human condition that, in my opinion, was in Alaska natives, certainly before Alaska became a state, that there's a prohibition throughout the constitution against spending, sectarian schools for religious because they don't have a good name. So we're on to something here. But the question is how to get from here to there. And
Mentioned with the last being given, speaking teachers in person, what would that look like?
that she's gone through that chair. So we've been talking Alaska Native Language teachers for the past few years in particular about what are the significant changes that we would like to see made. And one of the things that has developed through a number of discussions, including a very large gathering at the University of Alaska Fairbanks a few years ago, where I invited people from Hawaii and Mohawk people from the Six Nations to talk about what they do and to really work with us. And then we invited some people from Aotearoa, from New Zealand, to a subsequent meeting in Kenai. Some of the things that we wanted to see was a pathway for licensure and certification of Alaska Native Language teachers. And so I think we're getting close to that, but we need to create some space. So, we have a certificate program at the University of Alaska Southeast, and this fall we're going to be proposing a Master of Arts in teaching Alaska Native Languages. And we'll just need some help on the state side to sort of pull that through. I think the other thing that's missing is an Alaska Native Language Schools Consortium, which would sort of be like a statewide school board for Alaska Native Language Schools and programs. But it wouldn't necessarily be doing the governing work of the school board. A lot of the difficulties that we've had in trying to build our own school was that the school in Navajo is the most successful language school I've ever seen. There's nothing that I've ever seen that's anything like it. And I encourage you, if you want to go, it's not before post-pandemic, there are many sicknesses to Hawaii, but I've been there several times, and the members speak Hawaiian, and you really got an insight of what they do. And it's unbelievable what they have done. But we are working with them specifically to figure out how we can do something similar. But in order to do that, you need to be a charter school. In order to be a charter school, you have to have permission from the school board to build your own school. And I don't think we have a supportive environment for them in Alaska because we have threatened budgets and because we have a system that can't really see anything other than itself. And so the attempts thus far have been unsuccessful. And when people have been asked point blank, like a superintendent who was in the junior, not the current one, the previous one, I said, do you support this? Would you support it? We can get language middle school. And they would not say yes. And so I think we need to find another pathway. And that pathway is saying, okay, let's form a working group and let's have an annual conference on Alaska Native Language Schools and programs. And let's have a dedicated focused effort on how we can possibly do this. Because if we drag our feet for much longer, we already saw the last sports speaker, of Halakachuk, and the last, that's going to keep coming. It's going to keep coming. It's not, we're going to lose probably 10 or so languages in the next 20 years if we don't do something, which is just, again, I continue to come back to, like, how can we not do anything when this is happening, and we can see it, and we have caught up. I can find reports and reports and reports that have talked about this, and so that's what I would hope to see, is basically those two things moving forward. And the pathway to certification, I feel pretty confident we're going to figure that one out, and the Department of Education here and early development is really on board with making this happen. But the consortium part might take something from the legislature to happen.
Good
job. I want to remind our committee members that we did pass those collect clean on this committee, which is open to certification for Alaska community teachers and some sort of education right now. I see our representative Karen has a question for Representative Parks, but I'm looking forward to this chair because we did have past Superintendent Walker also here to present this chair. But I would like Dr. Parker to speak about the language test here in town and a little bit about PCLM, just because some model programs that is through the Chicago School District. And I've been full disclosure, my daughter, Emma Story, teaches at the language test.
Yeah, I'll change contacts. Yeah, and I can always come back to it. So this time of day works pretty well for me. Thank you for that question. The TCLL program is magnificent. I think hearing the history of how it developed, I do believe. I think there's a small bar that was very interested for the intentions of that group of people that were there. But I think they just refused to hear it. So what they settled on was a program listed within the Harbor View School, which has been wonderful. As we've seen, the number of master-level course speakers just drop. We're so thankful that we got to have some of them, like Cassandra Selena Everson and Kim D.C., Anna Kethick, spend a lot of time with our kids. And they have, they know songs, they know dances, they know many, many phrases. They're really conversational in the language when the kids are reaching fourth grade. The difficulty is the program ends at fourth grade. I mean, we don't have something to do. Everything fifth grade, sorry. We don't have a program to continue, although we're trying to build those within the middle schools and the high schools. So, it is a program that's based in Kenyan culture. It is inclusive of the Kenyan language. They do have multiple language teachers. They can get a language teacher in every classroom, and we're trying to use that as a basic, basically a laboratory school, so that we can provide more teacher assistance to them, and then just continue to grow our ability to create teachers. And then a few years ago, I had a thought it could be a language nest for the Kenyan language opened up. And a language nest is an early childhood development center. It's essentially a preschool that functions entirely in Kenyan, and modeled after Hopkinton Malayo and Kahungaeo in both Hawaii and New Zealand. But the idea is to create a home where the primary language is your indigenous language. And we have kids who come in and they don't know any language, but by the time they leave, they can speak and they can understand pretty much everything that we say to them. And it's really just amazing if you drop a kid in there. But I used to go to Hawaii. Is it in your language list? Well, how long would it take if I just took some kid from Alaska and just dropped them in there? And they're there all day. They said, the 3 months that they speak in Hawaii, just lovely. And so I believe that these are the answer, or at least one in a series of part of the answer. And also in Heidelberg, where there's one birth speaker of Alaska Haida remaining, they have a functioning language nest down there in Heidelberg, and it's amazing. We can see these kids speaking. That is medicine for a lot of our people, to see children able to speak. And we're really thankful that Yakutat, but they were the first Kenyan language nest, and then the one in Kenya opened. The one in Kenya is still functioning. The pandemic was really hard because kind of had to shut it down because kids couldn't be vaccinated. And so it's a very close bubble right now, but they have been running since January again. And they have been producing a ton of material because one of the things, our languages were not only prohibited, we absolutely prohibited, but families also elected to stop speaking to their children in order to keep them from being discriminated against, in order to keep them from experiencing some of the same violences that their predecessors did because they spoke the language. And so, to see kids speaking now is just amazing. Especially, as I mentioned earlier, we're so thankful that some of our elders get to see it and that some of them get to know about it before we lose them, so that they know that we're doing everything we can to build the core.
Well, thank you for that, Professor Kendall. I am going to move on to some thoughts we're going to hold up for right now, and then we can, if you can stay on the line and we can open questions after we've heard from the Walker's effects this morning. So, Superintendent Walker, it is good to see you again. Welcome, and please state your name and get the license for the record and begin with your presentation on understanding cultural language. How relevant education.
And thank you, Board Chair Stone and members of the House Committee. For the record, I am building up Terry Walker, Superintendent for the Northwest Valley Rural School District in Coxsackie, Alaska. And today I would like to speak around New York Circle Program Committee that was established an education steering group in 2013 with members from the North Slope, Northwest Arctic, Bering Straits, and Southwest regions. The steering committee was to lead the process to develop an Alaska, and when I use the word Inuit, and when they use that word Inuit, it is to mean all of the Alaska Native tribes along with Greenland and Canada, the northern tribes. So it was to lead the process to develop an Alaska Inuit education improvement strategy. Each steering committee member held workshops with delegates in their respective region. And the workshop goals were to define education success from an Inuit perspective, review the current state of Inuit education in Alaska, and identify recommendations for the improvement of Inuit education. So the steering committee met throughout the fall of 2014 in the winter of 2015, and the education workshop recommendations, and turned the education workshop recommendations into a strong education strategy and action plan with measurable objectives. It was based on the following foundational values identified by the education workshop delegates that every person can learn. And we want to retain, we want to retain our own ways, including how we impart knowledge. We value family and community engagement. Students need to learn about and develop pride in their self-identity. They need to develop respect for elders and the cultural knowledge and identity they can impart. We want school authorities to understand the student perspectives and for teachers to be more supportive of the Alaska Native students, and for teachers to learn the things they don't know about the communities when they first come in. And so there were six improvement strategies that were developed. The first one was to promote the indigenization of education frameworks to align with Inuit ideologies or theory. Number two, suggest, advocate for, and influence policies related to Inuit education. Boy, I got a big break from there just to think that, you know, when I was reading through these again, that back then it was like, wow, is this ever going to happen? And I just had to smile reading through this, that, you know, I'm actually talking to legislators, you know, about influencing policies, you know, for the change, for the good of our people. So just really made me smile last night. Research, number three is research, advocate for and promote the development, implementation, and sharing of culture-based curriculum that focuses on students' identity as Inuit. Four, promote Inuit language education. Five, foster educational leadership capacity among Alaska Inuit. And six, revitalize and reclaim traditional Inuit parenting skills. So, because of time constraints, I'm going to just focus on number three, and maybe a little bit of number four, but the culture-based curriculum. And the action steps for strategy three, culture-based curriculum, were to create, was the creation of a traditional knowledge clearinghouse, specifically for Inuit research and resources. The efforts should be directed at gathering resources that are already found elsewhere to to avoid the duplication with the Merkel brothers. And sharing, the second one was sharing of culture-based resources and instructional strategies as appropriate for Inuit children should be encouraged across regions and schools and districts. Protocols would need to be developed both for sharing and accessing curriculum material. And the third one was individuals and organizations should be encouraged to create appropriate resources using local knowledge. And when students see themselves reflected in the curriculum, they develop pride in who they are. And parents can relate to their child's learning because parents have helped to develop the curriculum. When I talk about curriculum and the way that we teach, we focus on the whole child. And it's learning, something we call inunikikum, and it's our way of life, and it focuses on, you can't separate out like subject areas. It's the learning teaches the whole child, and so you learn about this, and it's all revolves around the seasons, and so everything is seasonal, and everything that you learn within the seasons, you learn about the culture, you learn about your well-being, you learn about your self-identity, you learn about the values, the spirituality, and the language is all intertwined in that. And there's so much more to that, but that's what cultural-based learning includes, and that culturally relevant schools have parents in there, and students have the desire to learn because they see that they are learning about themselves. And we need, of course, to have community involvement with elders, and especially at first, there's got to be a ton of community and elders put into the building to help shape, what that looks like. And for the support of the board and administration, and of course, you all there is to have increased budgets and to have equity in instructional time to focus on the English and then the native language. So, and then, our instructors do need more training. So I think I'm going to stop there and just see if anybody has any questions.
My question is, how do we call you and Professor Twitchell and Robert Ive? I don't have a particular question. I want to keep going and to hear what you're doing in the Northwest Arctic Borough School District along these lines. Thank you.
Superintendent Walker, I think Representative Gordon was asking if you have any specific examples about what you were planning to do that. You can share, please.
Yeah, I didn't understand that that was a question, so my apologies. And so, through the chair, Representative Devin, currently we are working to develop a science curriculum starting in the ninth grade. We could have chosen to purchase the curriculum with many of our other curriculum from down south, and which is where the curriculum is made. people hear that others and tribal leaders run on snow, another one on northern lights, and I believe during the UAF they also developed some curriculum on the Belugas, the Beluga Project with a couple of communities here, and they're just so much over the years. There's thousands of, I remember about hundreds of videos that were taken, especially in the 80s and 90s, of our local elders passing on knowledge. And I know that NADA has curriculum that where they went out to each of the communities and wrote place names and the language and then what those places were used for. We just need to get all of this curriculum together. So we've hired some curriculum specialists and we want to include the language, and of course we're seeking grant funding for this. All we can do is hire one specialist right now, and for both the English and the native language piece of it, and to try to create the scope and sequence of putting that all together, go through all of the resources that we have, and put them into the different content areas of that physical and earth science curriculum. One small bite at a time, that's one of the places where we're starting.
Thank you, Terry. We really appreciate hearing how hard you're working to create your own curriculum. That is a huge issue when it comes to curriculum culturally relevant schools. How can we better support you? I heard you say you're seeking grant funding. Clearly there isn't enough funding within your own budget to develop your own curriculum. And it sounds like it's way more expensive than buying the package from down south, as you put it.
Well, I think we spend more $500,000, for like even a reading curriculum, that's over $1 million for all of that, the curriculum and resources to get them here and then distribute them out to sites and everything. And it just didn't sit well with me to spend that kind of money on a science curriculum when we have our own science inside our own back door that our children can learn from our elders and the people in the community and where they can thrive in the area of science, I guess, so to speak. And so it's one step at a time, just working towards developing the, finding out what resources we have, getting them all together, putting them into, categorizing them, I guess, so to speak, into what could go in each as a unit, and then developing a scope and sequencing what holes do we have there. I think, right now is the funding so that we can, work to get our committees together of people that would do the writing, especially the language piece for the curriculum, and then also to get these people into the classrooms to help teach the kids. But that's a later date.
Something
I want you
to consider.
I'd be interested. to teach English to our students. Not that that's a bad thing, because I think that our students, every student, needs to learn the common language in order to thrive and succeed in their adult life. And getting a start out in early childhood education with our own curriculum called the Ikari Critical Reading Curriculum to learn the language and to learn, that's what we call it, like ABCs. But to have that start in the beginning with pre-K, the 4-year-olds, the 5-year-olds, it's just a,
I never checked what was called, but the school's
schools and just forego that federal assistance or how did that add up more media?
In case through the chair, I do believe that the funding was, I think the Department of Education gave. And so what they had was a lot of parent-led protests. So it wasn't the teachers. It was really interesting what they had in Hawaii, because every time they would add a grade level, it was because the parents kept saying, let's keep going, let's keep going. And then every time when they sort of were discussing the standard access thing, it was the parents who were protesting and on the school grounds and at the legislature. And saying, like, we don't want our kids to go through this. This is something that is contributing to failure. And so they ended up reaching an agreement. And if you look, the standards of education are waived for students in Puerto Rico, but they are not waived, and they're still not waived for indigenous languages. And so they are, I guess, something we should examine in terms of our work with the federal government and sort of saying, like, well, what are the standards and what should they be? Because I think, again, it's not an effective method. One certainly needs to learn in the streets of Boston, Massachusetts are not the same things that a student needs to learn in the village of Ekeleku or Yangon. And there are certainly some things, like, there are things. So I think some of the reason people get nervous is they think some of us are saying, well, let's just do anything we want. And that's really not the case. The case is we have competent teachers and administrators, and we can move towards a more localized model and a more regional model and then a more statewide model. And I think if we were to reform with that in mind, I think it would become more place-based and become more successful. A lot of Indigenous peoples reject education because they don't see themselves in it. They see it as something that they have to conform to. And if that's the case, then what might look like failure is really just determination to be themselves.
Without complying necessarily with the standards set for that federal funding. Is that correct?
Okay, Chair, yes, that is correct. So they were never granted an exemption, which is, it's a mystery to me, like, why that would never happen. But I think, one, if their state legislature stood up for that school, and two, well, number one is the parents, and number two is part of the state legislature, and then three is their federal representatives, and the federal congressional members stood up for them as well. And so there's just sort of, you know, for the report that was done by Dr. William Wilson and Dr. Kamala Kamana, and I can also, I do have access to several folks who were over there if this committee was interested in hearing some of the particulars. And they would get better answers if you were to talk to either of them, because they were there on the front lines figuring out how to do that. But they did have to reject the system and also be threatened by the system, because education can say, well, if you don't do it our way, we'll pull everything. And, and so what we see is a system that's not functioning very well in terms of looking at people and allowing them to decide how education should be structured. If you have a model that's trying to fit all of the United States of America, which includes well over 400 indigenous languages, I think you radically increase the chances that it will not be inclusive of indigenous peoples, because it just doesn't work that way. And I think most education systems don't teach, again, in Hawaii, by the reason why they get this was because the misrepresentation of their own people in education was horrible to them. how they know their history and what their children were coming home and telling them was absolutely incorrect, which is another case. Like, one, so little information is typically taught specifically about Indigenous peoples when the information is taught about the world. And it is often sort of using non-primary sources. It's not using Indigenous voices to teach about Indigenous content.
I'm curious to know if any of the dual language programs that you have in your region show similar data. And I'm also interested to hear, as we heard this morning, that Native students are often not reflected in their own educational system. What are the efforts of the Borough School District to have the resources to design a place-based curriculum to ensure that reflection is made available instead of having to purchase curriculum from the Oroponi? Is that an adoption that you anticipate your program pursuing?
I'm starting with that second question, and I'm going to say absolutely it is the direction of the board to create place-based, culturally relevant curriculum where our students can thrive. And our parents and our the people in the communities have ownership of these schools. When you walk into our buildings right now, it doesn't reflect our culture. And so when we walk into the building, we want to make sure that it is a reflection of our culture. And by developing the curriculum that we need to make that happen, it will. I know that it will have tremendous positive gains and effects on student learning. And to answer your first question, I can only speak to that from secondhand information because I'm new in this position only since the pandemic, but I have heard that students who have attended the McKay Tilt school, and much like Dr. Twitchell mentioned, that their immersion program paused for a while due to the pandemic, and that's been the case here, they probably have been reopened, but then closed again and then reopened. And I know that they have had turnover in staffing. And so I think that but in the past when it was run by Nick, who when they were referred to, they had success in that immersion school and students were coming into our system after going to school there for like 2 years, coming back into our system with not knowing much English at first, or reading and writing part of it, and then later on, like you said, mentioned, later on in the upper elementary grades,
Thank you.